Thank you. We welcome, and we were anxious to get started with our presentation tonight because I know the 8 o'clock witching hour will come very fast. And I just want to say a couple of thank yous. First of all, thank you so much to Lester Marks and the Lighthouse for hosting us. And they, I guess I should admit who I am. I'm Karen Borgie, and I'm the chair of the Pedestrians for Accessible and Safe Streets PASS. And a lot of people from the PASS steering committee are here. If you guys want to clap or holler or admit to your existence, you can do it.
I'm here.
You're here.
Excellent. Yep, so you know we have Craig Wayne, we have Ellen Rubin, we have Maria Hansen, Ben Stewart is here, Lester Marks again.
Audrey. I'm here.
Audrey, yeah. Shading. All these are the people you can blame. No. Okay, but seriously, it's a very exciting opportunity to be able to have the chance to learn what's new in the area of accessible pedestrian signals, how they fit into the whole context of travel, and what we need to know in order to make, as I like to think of it, make the city sing with these APSs so that we really get, we can be more empowered as we travel. And there are three people who are going to present to us tonight, and I'll just say a word about each of them, and then we'll roll. Chris Pagniello is going to start us off. Chris is with Traffic Systems, Inc., I guess, and that means that Chris has the contract with the city, represents the Polaro Corporation, which makes the APSs. And so Chris is going to be able to demonstrate to us various kinds of new sounds and review for us what a locator tone is and the walking indicators and all those things that make the APSs do what they do. And so we're really grateful. Chris slept down from Albany today, so we're really, really grateful for that. And then the other two people who are going to help us work with these issues are Lucas Frank and Janet Barlow. And Lucas, as many of you probably know, is with the Seeing Eye, and Janet runs a company called Accessible Designs for the Blind. And the thing to say about both of these presenters is that they have a deep background in orientation and mobility. They have a huge commitment to accessible environments for those of us who are blind and visually impaired. They really partner with us, and they work toward our, not to say empowerment again, but that's what it is, really. And their commitment and creativity and persistence when it comes to these issues that they've worked with for us is unbelievable. They both worked on the national, state, and local level. And when you say local level, I mean these guys both have been all over the country and probably the world trying to work with traffic engineers, with city governments, and with us, with the community, to make APS accessibility a reality and real accessibility a reality. How clever is that? Anyway, you know what I mean. They've been trying to make real independent, happy travel, safe travel a reality for us. So I'm very, very grateful. Maybe we could just give all our presenters right now a huge round of applause. So I think if it's all right, Chris, are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, so let's start with Chris, and then you can flip it over to Lucas and Janet, and there will be time for questions at the end. Oh, before I just let this go, you know I like to talk. I have to introduce one more person to you, and you'll maybe be able to hear from him a little bit at the end. From the Mayor's Office of People with Disabilities, we have their Transportation Coordinator, Matthew Vogel. Matt, could you just say hey?
Hey. Hi.
And And we are being recorded tonight. It's our hope that this recording will be on the PASC website soon. So don't say anything you don't want to be known for generations and generations. Okay, I am going to turn it over to Chris. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Chris Pacquiao. I work for Traffic Systems Incorporated. We're based on Long Island. As Sharon said, I came down from Albany today. I work out of the Albany area. We've been working with New York City for, I guess, it's probably about 7 or 8 years now since the original ones, the original units went in. We've been a Polaro representative for probably about a dozen years, and over the last, I'd say 5 to 6 years, you really see these units starting to take off. Everybody from New York City DOT to New York State DOT, Nassau County, Suffolk County, Westchester, you see that they become much more prevalent. We've installed quite a few of them. New York City has bought quite a number of them. I'm not sure how many they've installed at this point, but they've certainly got quite a few out there. They do have a program in place where they're installing so many per year, per month. What I was asked to do tonight is talk a little bit about some of the functionality of these units, because they have evolved quite a bit over the years, and kind of show you, play some of the messages, the tones, the various sounds that they'll make. Because I guess part of the reason for tonight is to talk over some of the options, I guess it is, for some of the various locating tones and walk sound tones. So I guess we can kind of dive into that. For what it's worth, these units, the newest generation of these units have quite a bit of flexibility. They can really virtually do anything you want them to. They have time of day schedules, so they can do different things during different times of day. In the past, it was somewhat of a process to record a new message in them or to put a new sound into them. Now the units are able to be programmed really easily. You just basically program in with a laptop, and whether it be a voice message or a particular tone or whatever it is you want it to do, it's very, very easy to modify or change how the units function. They have second, third language options, and even the way they operate based on the traffic control system that's in place, very flexible, very easy to work with. So with that, I'll start playing some of the tones. First thing is the locating tone. Obviously, the locating tone is intended to provide a target or provide a way to find the unit on the pole. So there's several different variances of those. You have the manual uniform traffic control devices, which is the federal guidelines for how these things operate. Most agencies adhere to that, so a lot of the tones you hear are MUTCD compliant tones. They're based on frequencies and studies that maybe Jack can speak to some of that. They seem to be very involved in that, probably much more so than myself. They are all developed for with certain rationale in mind. So while we can have them do virtually anything, we don't necessarily want them to do virtually anything. So the tones that you hear are all kind of recommended sounds and tones that fall within those guidelines. So you have a couple of different options for the locating tone, and I'll just play a couple of those. Let's see here. So, well, there's nothing real dramatic. These sound once per second, and again, they are intended to kind of bring you into the accessible pedestrian system. And again, there are different tones that can differentiate different units that are on the pole. So you have a couple of different versions of it. I think what's probably more interesting is the actual sounds when the walk signal comes up. You do have an extended push or an informational message. They have the capability of when you arrive at the APS or the accessible pedestrian station, you can push the button and it will tell you, it can give you some type of information, whether it's the direction you're traveling, whether it's just to wait, or whether it is what street you're crossing. So we have some options as far as that goes. When you get into the actual walk sounds, there are a variety of different schools of thought. There are voice messages that tell you what street you're crossing. There are what they call the rapid tick or the machine gun that you probably hear on the streets here in New York City. There are different versions of that. There's the old cuckoo and chirping, which were the Canadian standards from years ago, that you still see used in some places. You also have some international sounds. So, again, we have a variety of them. Then you have clearance mode sounds, what it does when it goes when the walk signal goes away, because we don't want to send people into a crosswalk when that walk signal is no longer up and we go to a flashing hand or a clearance phase. So there's a variety of different things you can do during that phase, too. In terms of the walk, the standard one that you're probably familiar with is the machine gun that we hear, right? We have different versions of that. And again, these are not unique necessarily to Polara. They are kind of industry standard tones. Less like a machine gun, more like a alien spacecraft or something along those lines. We have another one. That would be the woodpecker, I assume. And that last but not least. You'll notice that the frequency and the duration is pretty much the same. These would sound throughout the walk signal, walk phase of the intersection. Again, the frequency, how rapidly it repeats, is kind of a standard, and that's, again, based on the federal manual. You do have a couple of other versions, although they're not typically used. In cases where you have an exclusive PED, there are some locations, usually sitting in universities and corporate campuses, where all the walk signals come up together. And that would be...
Walk sign is on for all crossings.
Yeah, because the entire intersection is in red, so all crossings now are essentially the walk sound is up. You have the Canadian melody, which is not really in use here. We have the old cuckoo and the chirping. That's kind of faded away. You don't really see that a whole lot anymore. And then last but not least, you have your custom voice message, which is in use. You'll see in some places here. Depending on the generation when they were installed, the city in some cases has a voice message. In some cases, they're using the rapid tick. I believe MUTCD calls out for if they are co-located, was it within 10 feet of one another, then you are to use a voice message. If they're separated, where you can differentiate one versus the other, then we go to the rapid tick.
Broadway. Walk sign is on to cross Broadway.
So again, you have those various options. You do have the options also combining those sounds. We can do a custom message in conjunction with the rapid tick. So again, I think you'd indicated, I think MUTCD calls out for the rapid tick, then the street, then back to the rapid tick, I believe it is.
I don't know that that's specified in MUTCD.
Oh, how they do it, okay.
Yeah, I don't think that's it.
That is an option, though. So, you know, the point to all this is it can be, it's versatile enough that basically you can have it do whatever you like, or whatever's requested. When we get to the clearance phase, we do have basically a couple of options. Normally it returns to a locating tone, and again, that gives you a target on the other side of the street. You do have countdown available.
30. 29.
Which essentially will count down how many seconds are left during the clearance phase. You have wait messages that, you know, again...
North. Traveling north.
Wait to cross Broadway at 8.
Wait. That's considered an extended push or an informational message. Again, the point is, you know, we can have these units do virtually anything. Was there anything else that you need to be, you know, in terms of the sound? Those are basically the options, but again, those are defaults. We can basically anything that can be created on a WAV file can be programmed into the unit. So again, not that we want to have an infinite variety of sounds, but essentially you. Infinite variety of sounds available.
Bruce?
Yes?
On the locator, you just play one beat, but you could play more than one song?
Sure.
Because some people haven't heard
the locator. Yep. Yeah, if I unplug it, the unit's in a programming mode now. So what's in a programming, it just plays it once. If I can get this to crank up a little bit. The units have a microphone built into them, so they adjust themselves based on ambient noise. So if I'm real quiet here, it's basically once per second. It's like a sonar ping. You may have heard some of the units in the back here. I mean, actually, we could probably kick on one of those and we'll probably hear it a little bit better. This unit has been programmed down for this. I have the volume set kind of low because when you're doing a trade show and you listen to that locator tone all day long, and stuff like that. And things like that. Yes. Is that one? Yep.
Thank you, Chris.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Lucas Frank from the CNI. Wonderful to be here and to have an opportunity to talk about these issues at this sort of critical moment in terms of New York City, where we're really at the point of making some decisions that will have an impact on us going forward. Before we jump into the future, though, I'd like to go backwards for a few minutes into the past and tell you how we got here, because I think it's important that you understand something that Chris touched on, which is that New York City is part of a national context, and that we fall as a city within the United States at a point where we can make some serious mistakes, I think, or make some good decisions. Going back to Watertown Square in Boston, Massachusetts, does anybody know, anybody here at Perkins grad? No, it's a New York City crowd. they had bells in Watertown Square because it was very close to the Perkins School for the Blind to help the blind kids get across the square. But they were very difficult for people to understand. But it was an early attempt to create accessibility of the signals there in Massachusetts. And that goes back to like the 30s and 40s. Between that time and the year 2000, there was absolutely no standardization in terms of accessible signalization of street crossings. No standardization at all. There was no regulation concerning accessible street crossings. And that meant that one of two things happened. Either a particular traffic engineer, in response to a request by some blind guy who couldn't get across the street, would say, sorry, there's no regulation, we can't do anything to help you. Or sort of a different brand of traffic engineer, they come in two flavors, would say, there's no regulation, I can do anything I want, what do you want to do? And so you had a variety of bells and horns, I've heard horns, all kinds of weird stuff. They would just go into the closet and stick it up in the corner. And it would be functional for that individual. It would help that person, but it did not create accessibility on a broad scale. Then finally, in the year, just before the year 2000, the National Committee on Uniform Traffic Control Devices took up the question of creating a national standard for accessible pedestrian signals and putting something into the manual of uniform traffic control devices that Chris talked about. And the initial language there was very, very vague. What it kind of put in is saying that you can't do accessibility without prescribing particularly well how you do it. At the time, probably the most common signal in the United States was a cuckoo and a chirp. And that had become a de facto California standard. And it became a de facto California standard because some American engineers saw it in Japan and really liked it and thought it was cool and brought it over. And the cuckoo stands for which direction? How many people say north-south clap? Let's give a clap. How many people say east-west clap? Nobody knows. Nobody has.
We don't know.
Okay. Either that or you still like clapping. Could be either way. Anyway, the cuckoo stands for north-south. The chirp stands for east-west. There's absolutely no rationale to that. It's easy to remember, though, because there's an O in cuckoo. And there's an O in north. But so that became a de facto California standard and also in Canada. But there were lots of problems with that because nobody knew whether they were, you know, in the United States, by and large, nobody knows whether they're going north, south, east, or west anyway, and often the signals weren't spelled backwards. So there was a need for standardization. The first edition of the manual that came out with standardization was in the year 2000, which, being a federal guidebook, came out in 2001. So over the years, traffic engineers being what they are, we created They demanded that there be research to support any type of change to the manual. Often this is the sort of water is wet, prove it sort of research, but it needed to be done, and it was done very well, largely and most often by Janet Barlow, who's going to talk next. Some of the research that has been done was we knew that there should be a locator tone. What should that locator tone consist of? Well, there was research done at the American Council of the Blind Convention in Los Angeles, what year? 2002, maybe, that led to the actual decision that the locator tone should be at a once per second rate of the grandfather clock like tick that you heard, as opposed to a once every 5 second rate or a 3 second rate. There was actually research that went in to say this is the tone that was preferred and was most effective in getting people to push button polls efficiently. At the time, by the way, in Montreal, it was a 5 second rate, I think. And so what you would see is you would see people take a step, there would be a tick, people would take a step, wait 5 seconds, and then it would tick, and then you move towards it again. It was kind of a waltz that people would do to get to a corner. So, you know, a once per second rate was decided to be very efficient based upon research. Another piece of research was done at an ACD convention in Des Moines on the quality of speech messaging. The message that says Broadway walk sign is on across Broadway was tested, and as a result of research, people understood it at a very high rate. That's why that format is in the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. There's a feature on these signals that Chris touched upon where you can hold the button down and you'll get an additional level of information saying that basically this signal is to cross Broadway, not to cross 23rd Street. Well, how long do you hold the button down for? Our initial language said it should be a 3 second press. Well, who says 3 seconds? Maybe you need 5 to be sure that you don't get accidental annoying activations of that feature, or what? So research was done, and it turned out that you didn't need to have more than 1 second of prep, because nobody presses buttons for more than a quarter of a second, actually. So if you have a 1 second, you can get it pretty easily without fatiguing people who are trying to hold the button down. At the same time in the manual, there was a push away from language towards symbolism. The most common change where that you see in this regard is many of you New Yorkers, I'm a New Yorker, I grew up in the city, remember you always had walk, don't walk signs, right? We still call them walk, don't walk signs, right? It said walk, and then it would start flashing an amber, don't walk. Everybody remember those?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
With a hand.
No, they didn't have a hand in the old days. Now they have a hand because they went away from language, which being a multicultural society, not everybody reads English. So they had to say, what are we going to do to make this available to people who don't read English? And they figure a walking figure, which is in white light, is a pretty universally available symbol. And a red hand saying stop is a pretty universally available symbol. So they could get away from language. So there was some more research done on how to get away from and what to use for a standardized U.S. national walk indication. And that's what Chris was referring to in the manual, which is the rapid tick at well-installed signals, the woodpecker-type sound. Okay? The speech messaging, which I understand is very popular and I understand why it's popular, has some problems that Janet will bring out, but it is the only solution where you have two devices too close together or on one pole that makes any sense. However, it may not be preferable where at well-installed signals, and we're all in favor of well-installed signals. There's another bit of research that was done, which was never published, but some of you may have actually participated in it. Many years ago, in 2003, I did some research in Morristown, New Jersey, which is where the seeing eye is. And we were able to get 6 different signals installed in the downtown area. Did anybody play with me on that research at all in this room? Okay. We had 75 people come through some of the New York City residents, and look at all the signals. We had not quite the rapid ticket you heard today, but we had the Australian signal, which is very similar to that, in that it's a rapid tick with a tone in front of it. It goes bing, tick, 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 tick. We had speech messaging. We had a handheld transmitted device, a talking signs transmitter. We had a just vibration signal that only you had to have your hand on it to get vibration. We had an overhead cuckoo chirp, and we had a cuckoo chirp from the push button. The most popular, by a narrow margin, was the rapid tick. And I think what turned the corner was probably hearing loss. People who were in the group who had some level of hearing loss struggled, particularly in noise, to decipher street names from a walk message. And for that reason, I think, although I can, and I'm certainly glad to give and send anyone a copy of the study, I have a copy with me. You want a copy? You're welcome. Give me my copy. And it was basically a survey, it was semi-randomized. But the most popular was the rapid tick, followed by speech. So at that point, what I'd like to do is I'd like to give it back to Janet to talk a little bit about the research that she did on walk indications and what she found in that research. Thank you very much.
Hi, good to see everybody here tonight. Good to be here. Research idea, there were two big research projects that I was involved in. I wasn't the only person, there were a number of people involved, and many blind people. Over the course of 3 years, we tested somewhere between 200 and 300 people who were blind at various types of intersections in their making crossings at intersections. One project was funded through the National Eye Institute, a project through Western Michigan University on crossings at very complex intersections. So it was intersections that were angled in different ways, had a lot of complexity to their signal timing. At those intersections, we had people crossing without the accessible pedestrian signals installed, and then had a post-test where the city installed the accessible pedestrian signals, and then we had people make those crossings again, and we're comparing their crossings with and without the accessible signals, as well as getting information and feedback from them on the different types of signals and how well they worked. The other big research project was funded through the National Cooperative Highway Research Program, which is a program that is funded through our state DOTs, so that it was actually the traffic guys who were paying for this research, which was a really new for me and interesting and useful. And it's overseen by panels of that are looking at the research. In that research, we were looking at different manufacturers' APS and installing them at relatively similar intersections in the same city, having people who are blind cross at those APS that were developed and manufactured by four different manufacturers, and recording information about how they did on those crossings, as well as their personal preferences. That happened in three different cities. Then there was also another section of that our panel approved that looked at different kinds of installations of poles and sounds in one city and had approximately 90 participants, some with low vision, some were totally blind, some with cognitive disabilities. In particularly the NCHRP project, we were looking at the voice messaging, rapid tick messages, and cuckoo chirp type signals. In the end, to keep this relatively short, I can go into more detail if you want me to, what was the overall response? And remember, we were recording data about how well people crossed, how long it was before they started crossing after the walk indication came on. how well they did in making those crossings that point. And in the end, overall, rapid tick messages were detected by most people, including those with hearing losses, got a faster response in terms of crossing, were better understood as long as the poles were installed in the proper locations in relation to the crosswalk. And what ended up being, as a result of some of the other research, the recommended location for the poles was for them to be installed in line with the crosswalk line, in line with the crosswalk line that was furthest from the center of the intersection, or furthest from the parallel street, and lined up with that crosswalk line. The voice messages in almost all the testing were something that many people liked, but in truth, when they made crossings using the message, they were slower to respond and made more mistakes. Some of the reasons are, Lucas mentioned briefly there, was we think they were harder to understand in noise. When you overall look at voice messaging or speech messages, you have to have a message that's understood in noise. Traffic is usually noisy. You have to have a message that's understood by people who maybe speak different languages. And the message also has to be salient enough, to hear it in noise, not just understand the noise, but also hear it. What we found in the research was that, in general, the ticking sound was much more noticeable in the midst of traffic noise than any kind of voice message. Voice messages, if you're standing on a corner and lots of people are talking, it was hard sometimes for people to realize that they'd actually had the walk indication sound at that point. So that's the kind of a short version of the results of the research, where the first choice was to do some type of rapid ticking indication, which is used in many places in Europe and Japan now. And the second choice was to go with the speech message, which did clarify at places where the two push buttons were closer together, did clarify which one was sounding better when it was accompanied by the information message, so somebody knew which they wanted to hear. If you're standing at a corner and you don't know for sure which direction you're going, maybe you've gotten turned around or you're in a new city, different area, hearing that the walk sign is on the cross 23rd doesn't do you a bit of good unless you know that the street in front of you is 23rd. So there's a requirement when using a speech message that it also include a push-button information message that says, wait to cross 23rd at Broadway, so that when the walk sign comes up and says 23rd, walk sign is on the cross 23rd, you know that's the street you were facing, that's the message you wanted to hear. So it has to all go together. So if a speech message requires additional push-button information message to be installed with it, actually work well for individuals who are blind or visually impaired. Again, a result of the research, what we found. Question over there?
Yeah. The speech also has, when you press it and it's not time to go, it says, wait. If you're going to be using the ticking to cross, is there any wait message or is there?
There is a requirement in the MUTCD, the Manual Uniform Traffic Control Devices, that when you push the button, it says wait. And that is programmed part of the button. It should say wait once each time you push the button. It could say it again if you push the button again, but the requirement is for it to say wait when you push it.
And then so after that wait, you're just going to continue to hear the beeps.
That's right. Until it's time for the walk indication, and then you'll get a walk indication when that time comes. And when during the flashing of walk, after the walk, it goes back to the beeps again, the locator tone.
However, if you come up to an intersection, you push the button, and the traffic is in your favor already, I think it just starts the rapid tip. Because why wait? It's telling you.
That could be the case. But if you come up and it's already in walk, then it starts it. It depends on the settings of the device in that case. I think there's some places or some settings that it could be that every time the walk is displayed visually, the audible walk comes up. It seems in New York right now, they're not being set so that the walk comes up every time the visual walk comes up. So that's another question, at least in my mind, because personally I think that it makes it easier for sighted people to understand what that beeping's about if they get some kind of walk indication
yeah.
when the walk comes up for sighted people too. And so instead of, and it makes it easier for all of us to understand what's going on. But I don't know if we want to take too many questions. Lucas, do you have something else to say on that? Basics of the research I have, or if we got more questions, I can see two hands there.
And Janet, could I ask if you could try to kind of paraphrase or repeat the question, because I'm just conscious of the recording.
Oh, the recording. I'm
yeah.
sorry, I forgot about
oh,
that. Do we want to go to just questions, or was Chris going to...
I just want to add one sort of going back to fundamentals again. How many people in the room you can class have experienced overhead cuckoo chirp type signals anywhere in the world? The difference between what we're talking about and those overhead cuckoo chirp type signals is pretty significant, okay? The overhead cuckoo chirp type signals you might think of as loudspeaker signals. In other words, they broadcast to the entire intersection that there's a simple sound that says, cuckoo or chirp, and you have to know and interpret what that means. That you're going, that's for the north, south speed, the east, west speed. You may use other clues like traffic flow to help you figure that out, but it's symbolic in that way. And you have to know that. And so you have to know whether you're going north, south, east, or west. The types of signals we're talking about are conceptually different. The concept came actually from Australia. But the concept is more akin to earphones or headphones, because you have two devices at a typical corner. And the one closest to you is the one that you're listening to. If you're waiting to cross Fifth Avenue, it might be the one on your left, and then around the corner on your right, it would be the one across 23rd Street. And the basic premise here is that the closest, it can be very quiet compared to the overhead cuckoo chirp type signals, because it's not a loudspeaker, it's a headphone, and it's right next to you. Does that make sense to everyone? So you have to understand the design concept that underlies these things just from the beginning. They are different in their nature from the overhead cuckoo chirp type signals. They are location dependent to be quiet. They can be very quiet if they're well located and near you. They will be louder if they're poorly located and have to be cranked up to be heard at the crosswalk.
Rephrase your question for the recording and see if I get it right. You were asking that if you're starting across the street, you hear the countdown, awful countdown, there's no way for a person who's blind to know how far they've gone or how much further they have to go if
yeah,
they hear it in the middle of the street. Right. That is correct, and actually at this moment in the MUTCD, the Manual Uniform Traffic Control Devices, audible countdowns are not allowed, partly for that reason, that there's a lot of question about whether they're helpful to individuals who are blind or visually impaired, because they make a lot of noise in the intersection. It's a continuous kind of 17, 16, 15, 14, but which might keep you from hearing, might help you keep you from hearing the traffic you want to hear. Five. And it's, four, you don't know how three, much further you have two, to go anyway.
I'm done.
I'm sorry, what?
If you're trying to listen for
right.
people to the car company or someone's happy, it takes a lot of point out. That doesn't interfere with your ability.
Exactly. That's. I think it could interfere with your ability to hear the traffic, and that's the reason at this moment they're not recommended to have an auto countdown in the EBTCD. It's actually not. It's not allowed by the EBTCD at this point. But there are many places that are installing them that way. But it is not actually allowed by the EBTCD, and I see lots of hands up. Awesome back and forth here.
I was going to say, just from a traffic engineering standpoint, those are, just so you know how they arrive at that, it's a federal standard when they arrive at those pedestrian clearance phases. It's intended, they look at a standard 4 feet per second, the average person walks 3.5 per second. So those times are determined by that. So the idea is that if you just stepped off the curb, and it now goes to pedestrian clearance, you should have enough time to get across that street, assuming you don't stop. So just for what it's worth, that's why there are different head times based on the width of the road.
What about senior
citizens? That's why it's probably...
You can be timed in different ways, in different locations. I don't know people's names. The woman in the back has had her hand up longest, I think. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for all of the signals that are up already. Has to do with 23rd Street. I live on 23rd Street, and they have a lot of signals there, as a lot of us know who frequent there. But I found out recently that there's a APS signal between 5th and 6th Avenue in the middle of the block. And I was glad of that because I needed to be on the other side of the street. I want to request that one be put between 6th and 7th because, as you know, the blocks as you go downtown, they are longer. And it would be nice to have one there so that if you need to get to the supermarket that's on the other side of the street, you don't have to go all the way to 6th Avenue or all the way to 7th Avenue to come back to the store that's in the middle of the block. No, there is one between 5th and 6th, so just put one there.
So let me repeat for the mic that you, for the recording, you were requesting additional signals along 23rd,
yes,
between 6th and 7th.
Yes.
Mid-block signals.
Yes.
And I'm not familiar with the area, so somebody else might have to answer this one.
Also,
I know that. But I'm talking about where
I live. Karen, let me know if I'm wrong here, but I think that this is a more general discussion. I don't think poor old Janet in North Carolina is going to be able to help you much with that particular installation. But, I mean, it's a fair... I think the issue is there's a need for signals. The question is, what's the best job we can do to put them in such a way that people are not annoyed and that they're effective for the traffic?
Yeah, I think it's right. I think we can't. New Jersey and North Carolina, it's hard for them to comment on specific situations, especially when there's no actual crossing there. There's no regular signal there. So.
But hopefully, we're not prepared tonight to really do that, but I hope there's a way to get requests to DOT and pass for various signals, and I hope people will do that, and maybe that's something for somebody to speak about at some point. Those of us from North Carolina and New Jersey.
Before we break up, I'll say a word about making those requests, and so we'll make sure that before you walk out of here, you know what to do if you want to request something. And I'll just say quickly before I throw it back to you all and more questions that the onus for making those requests is on the individual. You have to start yourself if you want an APS somewhere, and then pass and others will be able to help, but you have to make the initial outreach. But we'll get specific about that before we close up tonight.
Gentlemen in the
Yes.
Yes.
I have a question. I noticed in walking here tonight that there is an ATS on the northwest and northeast corners of 59, but not on the southeast and southwest corners of 59th Street.
So, which intersection?
I'm sorry, 59 and Lex. So why would they do that? Where is the, what is the logic behind that, since this is so well researched?
I can answer that.
Okay.
Thank you.
I know, but just come up here and answer it so that we can hear you.
Well, the question was, why is there one on two crosswalks of 59 and Lexington and not on the other two crosswalks?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And Ken says he knows the answer, so I'll let him answer it.
It's a long history, but back in 2004, when I got the very first ATSs in 23rd Street and 6th Avenue, the Department of Transportation says, you know, we have limited resources, limited manpower. In fact, they were more concerned about the manpower putting these things in than the dollar cost of buying them each. So he said, we can do the most important crosswalk at many more intersections if we don't have to do all four crosswalks at every intersection. So reluctantly, and I agree to that, I agree that the priority is to get into the most important crosswalks. So that's why, especially in the early days, number of intersections got it on only one or two of the four crosswalks. Another example is right near here too, Park Avenue and 59th Street. I don't know if they're there yet, but at first it was just to get across the northerly crosswalks on Park Avenue.
Well, one more item on the hard list, but is it true now that the city has adopted the philosophy of when a traffic signal is in need of any kind of a repair at all, it's then deemed to it gets replaced with an ATS?
No.
The question was, is it true that the city's replacing whenever they're doing repair of the traffic signal, they're replacing it, they're putting in an ATS? And the answer from Karen was a clear no.
We
think they should.
Yes, PASS definitely thinks that they should. As I understand it, the COAG, right, the proposed regulations that govern ATS installation would say that. Am I not correct about that?
That's correct. Karen just mentioned that the draft public right-of-way accessibility guidelines or proposed accessibility guidelines for pedestrian facilities in the public right-of-way, I think that's what the Access Board has changed it to, are out for comment, have been for, comment period closed, and they're supposed to be coming out for final rules sometime in the next few months, we hope, and that those would require accessible pedestrian signals whenever a traffic signal is upgraded or replaced. But exactly how that would be applied is not clear quite yet.
Is
but certainly should be if they're doing a lot of work on it already.
Yeah, I just wanted to say...
thank you. I just wanted to say that I think that's a really important issue even for us to look at in the city. Because it seems to me it's something we, as a community, if we decide we want it, if we come together and decide that that's important, it's something we might be able to push for, especially when the new administration comes. So I think it's a really, really important question, because right now the law in New York City says that 25 intersections per year will be equipped with ATS. That's all. And anybody know how many intersections there are in New York City? 13,000. So that would be a little slow. So we, it's one thing. We have law now. It's in the law. That's something good and something new. But now we're going to need to move forward because I think, especially the way streets are changing in the city, it's constant. This is PASS talking. I think PASS people would back me up on this. 25 a year is too slow.
Yeah, but they are rolling them out faster than that. I've seen at least four go up just in the little section that happens in the last couple of months. They are rolling them out faster than that, but
Martha.
That's just what's on the books. We got another question back here. Let me go to take the microphone to you, sir. Here you go.
Thank you, Robert. I live in Brooklyn. I noticed that I've approached a number of assistive pedestrian signals, and a couple of them they weren't working. That's one issue. I said, but you can't even contact when they don't work. And the second issue is that I noticed that the volume on very, very busy intersections, one on Flatbush in particular, the volume was very low. And I said, well, how do you adjust the volume? That was my question.
The volume on those devices, and Anna Lynn, you may have a better handle on that first question, but the volume on those devices is variable. They're designed to be, and Chris can talk about that a bit more towards the end, but they're designed to be variable so that when loud traffic comes by, they get a little bit louder, and then when they're quiet, they drop back down to a lower volume, and they're very, very flexible and can be set relatively easily. Getting them just right is a trick, and it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. And I think that it's interesting that we talked for just a second about the devices here, and this is sort of what the bee that's in my bonnet, and I keep bringing this up, so forgive me, but the devices there on Park Avenue and on Lex, some of them have been vandalized, clearly vandalized by the people who live above them, you know, who they're being driven nuts by. So being on the low end, as long as they're effective, is, in my opinion, for the betterment of the city and for the betterment of all of us in the long term to prevent backlash. Keeping them on the low end of functional is a good idea. Now, I'm not saying that the one you're working with is perfect at all. Maybe it's way too low. But if it's tolerable, stay on the low side, especially in residential neighborhoods, I believe. That's my personal opinion.
The one thing I want to add to that is that the intent of this type of APS is not necessarily to be heard for the entire crossing. There's some different functions you can do in terms of holding the button down that can boost the volume of it, but in general it's supposed to allow you to know when to start crossing, and you use your other skills for the directional information to hear all the way across. So that's the other part that's not like the older type of cuckoo chirp, which didn't continue the whole time anyway, but it is intended just to give you information of when to start crossing. If you hold the button in for more than 1 second, there is a feature that can be set, may or may not be set on these devices, that allows the sound to be boosted up for that particular pedestrian phase, so that it will be louder walk indication and a louder locator tone for the rest of that crossing. So that may be something to try if you're having some difficulty hearing the walk indication, to see if it does get louder if you hold that button in for more than a second.
And you can also touch it and get vibration from it.
Who to contact to replace damaged or vandalized them? And I have to leave that to somebody from New York because I'm from North Carolina.
Matt, can I mention your name?
Sure.
So, as I told you, we have with us Matt Q. Vogel, who is the...
she doesn't like me yelling.
We have with us Matt Q. Vogel, who is the coordinator, transportation coordinator from the Mayor's Office for People with Disabilities. Matt, if I hand you this mic, will you give people your contact info so that they can register these issues with you?
Sure.
And you can get them to DOT?
Sure.
It's coming back to you.
Got it. So with any requests or any outstanding issues with the signals, if the signals are not working, or if you want to request a signal, you can contact our office. And my contact information, you can send it to me because I deal with the requests. I send them on to DOT. So my email. Alright. So my email, it's M, and my last name is Pavogo. P is in Peter. U V like Victor. O G E L at cityhall.nyc.gov. And my number is 212-788-8948. I am actually taking another position, so I'm going to be in the office till December 6th. You could send the signal request and any issues you have with the signals. After that, I guess if I'm not in the office, our general number is 212-788-2830.
Okay.
Another question over.
Hi. I had one experience that was very good with the signal. It was in an unexpected place. I didn't know it was there. Hearing perception on the east side, first and second avenue, I think. Suddenly there was a locator tone, pushed the button, and I could cross a street that I would not have been able to cross otherwise. I was thinking about the signal a lot everywhere else I go. And a lot of the places I spend time are congested areas where it's a fight to get to the curb. And I cannot imagine trying to get to a pole, push the button, to get the tone, to get the signal. And it doesn't mean knowing when the light has changed wouldn't be really, really useful, as opposed to following people and not hearing traffic and then suddenly there's a car coming. Somebody brought this up at another meeting, and I was ambivalent about it. And now I really think they're not going to be useful in some parts of the city unless they're going all the time. The locator button thing implies you could walk up to the pole, as I did in the non-congested place where there was nobody around. That was great. But as I said to the guy before, I can't imagine like shoving people out of the way. I mean, which I have to do. It's a shove to just sometimes get, and this sweet little small CNI trained guide dog who isn't going to push people out of the way, and people for sure. And I think just getting around is hard, and it would be great to just have the information, but to do the work to get to the locator buttons, to get the information, it doubles the effort, as far as I can tell.
I think it's a good point. From my perspective, I've been, for the last several years, advocating that if the visual walk comes up for sighted pedestrians, the audible walk should come up for people who are blind. And at most of the signals in New York City, the visual walk comes up for pedestrians every cycle. And right now, blind people have to go find a button and push it in order to get the same information that sighted people are getting. And I think you should be getting the auto walk every time, but that's my opinion from North Carolina.
I have a question regarding, it seems like we're using like this technology that was developed in 1990, was tested in early 2000, and being implemented in 2012, 2013, 2014. And I get the point about residential neighborhoods, especially in areas like this in Park Avenue, where you spend $2 million for a flat over here, and then you've got to listen to this beeping sound. And I understand that may aggravate some people. What technological developments that I do know in France, where they have systems now that are using, I guess, Bluetooth LE to interface with smartphones, so that blind and visually impaired people are using a simple app when they get to a corner can get directional information, you can get crosswalk information, get signal information. Is anything being implemented? Is anyone testing that? Is anybody developing that here in the States? Are they talking to DOT about it? I know the MTA is looking at a system called AccessWay, where they're looking to implement that in the subways to give us information. But it seems like we're still going to be listening to clicks and beeps and everything else going on street corners for the next 25 to 30 years.
My general answer to that is when they get rid of the traffic signals for the cars, they can get rid of the traffic signals for the pedestrians. But I may be wrong on that. But the fact of the matter is there has been some research going on in the U.S. on that type of thing. So far, GPS and other devices have not been accurate enough to actually do traffic signal information. I think they've had that same problem in France with that it hasn't actually worked very well unless it's someone who can point the handheld device exactly in the right location to get the signal properly, that if they're slightly off at an angle in the intersection, they may get the wrong signal. So they've had some problems in the research I'm aware of in terms of having those handheld devices really give the accurate information they need to be giving. I think there's stuff going on. There will be developments, but I think they're also doing things with cars talking to each other, too. So I don't know how long it's all off. It may be much sooner than we think, but I think there is work going on in all kinds of ways. Luke may have more to say on that.
I was just wondering about the cars talking to each other, that the BMWs can talk to the Fiat. I was just talking on a sidebar with Chris here, and he was saying that what he understands is that Bluetooth is going away and going to be replaced by another technology, which makes sense. Everything is, the company's got to make money and come out with something different. But, you know, and I know that there is some work going on with motion detection so that signals don't go off, aren't giving you locator tones when there's nobody in the neighborhood. In New York, of course, there's always somebody in the neighborhood. But, you know, so that type of work is going on. And I'm aware, I've actually been in Paris and looked at the signals that you're talking about, and they're interesting.
They're cheaper. That's why they're using them.
But then, you know, my guess is that there are considerable issues with that, too, that we just don't hear about. Everything looks great on the other side of the pond, as they say. You know, but it's an interesting system.
Hi. When discussing some of the features of the apps, in case people didn't have the opportunity to go touch them, could you discuss the tactile arrow and also the vibro-tactile features? Because I know a lot of blind people don't realize that the apps have these features.
Yes, the part of the requirements as written in the manual of uniform traffic control devices are that the devices have an arrow which points in the direction of the intended crossing, and they should be lined up in the direction that you want to be headed. And what was the other feature you wanted?
The vibro-tactile.
Oh, and also a requirement is that the devices vibrate when the walk message is being given, whether it's a rapid tick or a speech, that it should vibrate so that people who have significant hearing losses or are deafblind can have their hand on it and have that same information.
Two things. Jan and I agree. I've seen in Dublin and Waterford there were devices that the blind person doesn't have to look for the button, which I really like. I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but anyway, the only thing I wanted to say was about a year ago, you know, I'd like to say that the traffic engineers, DOT, always get it right, but nobody always gets it right. About a year ago, I had a situation where I was crossing the street. I guess I won't say where. Some people will still get me there, and I'll tell you, but I was crossing, and I listened to the ABS, and I checked the arrow, the position of the arrow, and then I also, fortunately, listened to what should have been the parallel traffic, and I realized that if I had followed the auditory direction of the ABS, I would have walked right out into the middle of a very busy avenue. My point being, it is critical for all of us to continue to use the skills that we learned when we learned mobility, of aligning yourself, even before you start to cross the street, aligning yourself to the parallel traffic, perpendicular traffic, whatever other auditory cues you use. ABSs don't replace any of those things.
As a mobility instructor and guide dog trainer, I can't agree with you more. On the other hand, we are in a situation where we're seeing serious deterioration in the pedestrian environment from a variety of angles. One is the increasing sophistication of signal timings and variability in signal timing. Gene Berkman, who is here, has done a nice little inventory of all of the what are called leading pedestrian interval signals here. Those are signals where, if you don't know, the pedestrian walk comes on before the cars move. Well, that's very nice if you can see them. But if you can't, then you're just going to wait for the cars to move. And, of course, the drivers think you're not leaving anyway because they can't figure out why you didn't go when you had the walk. So it puts you at increased risk. Quiet cars, you know, in the last 2 weeks, I've seen two Teslas. And if you think Priuses are quiet, wait until you don't see Teslas. They are really quiet, unless they're on fire, and then you can hear people screaming. But, you know, that's a whole different thing. We're really in a deteriorating environment from an access point of view. And so something that, devices that are, that equalize that balance again. I mean, we were always in balance. People who were blind could hear the cars watched the lights. There was a 1 or 2 second delay between when the car started and you started. It's a different game now, guys. It is changing quick. So, you know, I think it's quite urgent to do something smart, do it well, and do it universally. And I want to come back to that universal point. If you go to Nebraska, there's a street called Lincoln Avenue, and it crosses a street called Greenway. You might go to Lincoln, Nebraska, and you need to know that the device on your left, when it makes a noise, is for Greenway and not for Lincoln, you know, or whatever it happens to be. If it says Greenway, walk sign is on to cross Greenway, and you don't know if you're facing Greenway or Lincoln, you might have a whole problem there. So you, whereas I, driving through, will only have to look for a red light or a green light. I don't even have to know the names of the streets. And what these signals, if they're well installed and if they are standardized across the country, is they will give you the ability to cross any street in the same way that a driver can cross any street in a car, because you will have universal access to the signal information, the walk indication information, in a national standardized way. And I think that's important to push for. Having said that, I do want to mention that I was in San Francisco recently. And San Francisco had, for many years, as I said earlier, the cuckoo and the chirp system, where they had the cuckoo for north-south and the chirp for east-west. And there was quite a fight over what to do about these accessible pedestrian signals. San Francisco actually entered into a legal agreement to it, and when they lost a legal contest, to install a fairly large number on a regular basis. And what I heard when I was out there was something that Chris mentioned, which were sort of hybrids. And I'm reluctant to put this on the table, but I think I will anyway. It would start off with the cuckoo, but it also started off with a rapid tick, and then it said Milan Avenue, walk sign is on to cross Milan Avenue, but it started with a rapid tick. So I think, you know, that's something that could be debated and kicked around. It's the rapid tick is required by the MUTCD. That would be present, so maybe you could do both. I don't know.
I think this is such an important issue that in a way Lucas has raised now. Well, yeah, that in terms of deciding what the community really wants to do with regard to APS, can I ask, I don't know if this will work, but I'm interested in finding out, you know, PASS is a group. We've got like 30 different individual groups that are actually sign-ons, you know, that are part of the PASS coalition. They're all different branches of NFB, all different branches of ACB, various guide dog user groups. Lighthouse is a sign-on. Visions is a sign-on. Seeing Eye is a sign-on. I mean,
a whole lot of different groups. And so I'm just wondering, in this room here, would people be willing, but would people be willing to kind of, Jewish Guild, is this another sign on? I'm just interested, who in this group, what groups are you affiliated with? Let's just hear a little. Just holler them out, kind of.
ACB.
ACB,
NFB, Visions, what else?
Lighthouse.
What?
Lighthouse,
okay.
Audubon Society.
Audubon Society is not allowed. We're against the jokes of the groups.
Karen, Barbara Kim, Commission for the Blind.
Okay, Commission, great. Commission needs to be assigned. Anybody else?
Individual.
Mayor's office.
Mayor's office. What we're going to need to do.
CCLDF.
Council of Citizens with Low Vision, okay. We're going to need to find ways to come together almost as a result of this little group here, this meeting tonight, the recording that will be on the PASS website, and begin to build some kind of consensus about what seems to make the most sense. Not everybody is going to get everything they want. You know, I mean, it's not a perfect world. There's not $300 billion in the DOT budget. But we really have to find ways to think about what feels essential to us in terms of what's really the most helpful, what the most helpful kinds of things that we would like in terms of the APS opportunities that are available right now. So it's important that we sort of walk away here feeling like we know we have some information to work with. I'm wondering, do people feel like they would like to hear any of the sounds again? Is that a no? Okay, good. So everybody feels very well versed in all of those things, the different rapid ticks and the speech options and the locator tone, right? Because we're going to have to be looking at that stuff. And it's going to take everybody. It's going to take more than just the people on the PASS steering committee. So we're going to... I hope you all signed in today. Did you all sign in when you came?
No.
Do we have a sign-in sheet that we can prevent people from leaving until they sign in? We can block all of the
sign out.
Sign out.
I was sign in, but I was also greeting people and seating people.
Right.
So
you're
perhaps
right.
People could sign out your name and any other identifying information you'd like to share, such as your email address.
Like email.
I got a few of you. I didn't get everybody.
So is there a sign-out sheet somewhere? Or
by the door.
By the door.
And you can leave your information as you exit the room.
Okay. So let's see if there's more questions, and then I just want to say a couple things before we... Let's definitely have more
hands right now.
Thank you very much. A question about the countdown signals we talked about earlier in that comment, but I have my opinion on that. And before I mention that, just quickly on the quiet card, I got my information correctly. We did get federal legislation now that requires an audible aspect on quiet cards, but it doesn't go into effect until, I guess, 2015, so that's still far ahead of us. On countdown signals, I'm wondering if any panelists, I don't know, Janet has some information. What the research has shown thus far in terms of the impact of countdown signals. I've heard some comment about research that shows that it actually encourages daredevil behavior on the part of pedestrians, which, of course, is a negative. And I know on the other side of it, some of our local politicians, Gail Brewer-Cohen, has mentioned that she had an overwhelming demand for her constituents wanting countdown signals, so lots of people want them. My opinion is that that's the problem created by the transportation engineers themselves when they originally decided how to visually characterize the three phases. One phase is obvious, don't walk, that's the hand that's hooked up, and
pocket space and so that when a pedestrian is walking, the question is, what about that third phase, which Chris mentioned, is the clearance of time when what they really need is a symbol that says it's okay to finish, but not to start, not a flashing hand. My opinion is that flashing hand is misunderstood by a lot of people. They see the flashing hand, they don't distinguish too much between the flashing hand and the solid hand. I like better frost in that time. So I think that if they had a third single indicating very clearly, don't start, but it's fine to finish, but plenty of time to finish. So I'm wondering what the research has shown so far about the actual benefits or liabilities created by these countdown signals.
What I've not examined in any detail the research on visual countdown signals. The question was about the visual countdown signals and what the research is showing regarding those and pedestrian behavior. And I'm not real familiar with what the research is on the visual countdown signals. The Federal Highway Administration, I think, because of, Ken, what you mentioned about confusion about what the pedestrian signal means, went to requiring the visual countdown to help explain the visual pedestrian signal to sighted pedestrians. And it has had, from what I understand, as you mentioned, mixed results in terms of what pedestrians do, that they're crossing in the time, you know, shorter times. Most of the research seems to indicate that they get out of the street in time. They may be running across the street, but that they may start late, but they get out of the street in time. But there's definitely more need for research. I'm not sure it's happening.
Isn't there also inconsistency? Some places the countdown starts at the beginning of the walk phase.
There is inconsistency. It's not in accord with the MUTCD if it's inconsistent. But there's other questions coming here, and I think that was, you know, we don't want to go too long on this one.
Actually, this is related to what he said. I was talking to, I think, named Crystal, the lead teacher from Visions. If we press a button and we hear a walk message immediately, whether it's a beep, a gun, or a bullet, we should not walk because we don't know how long we have, you know, how long that walk will continue.
Well,
is that true?
I would disagree with that.
Okay, that's right.
Because of what, and I don't know who said it, I'm sorry.
No, he didn't say that, I'm inferring from that.
Okay, but if the walk indication is going, remember a few minutes ago there was a comment about the flashing don't walk is enough time to get across the street timed at 3.5 feet per second. So if you know you walk very slowly, maybe you don't want to go if you know the walk has already been going. But if you walk at a normal pace, if you start on the last, you know, part of the walk indication, you should have enough time to complete your crossing. So if you hear any piece of the walk indication, you should be okay with going ahead and crossing. But I wouldn't wait 5 seconds and then start crossing. At that point, you know you're close to the cutoff point. Does that make sense?
The other thing I was going to say about that is, at least with the units that we sell, with the Polaro ones, if you push the button and it's already in the walk phase, I don't believe it'll start doing the tones. I think it actually is waiting, if I'm not mistaken.
It depends on how you set it.
Yeah, I think it'll
depends on how you set it.
Yeah, I think New York City DOT, the way those are set, I don't believe that it will start to wait till the next time around.
And I don't think that's really fair to pedestrians, pedestrians, to make them wait longer.
Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, it's a safeguard. I don't think
okay, so it depends on how it's set. And that's what Gene said, and it does different things. And I think that's true. I think it does different things depending on the settings.
But if I listen to Bob, well, that walk thing was going to go away. Could you just briefly go through walk, flashing, don't walk, and don't walk? Because people think they should only be walking during the walk.
I always describe this as appetizer, main course, and dessert. The walk indication is typically, in many instances, only about 7 seconds. Depending on the nature of the, I understand, Gene, but depending on, in New York City it's a little different because it's all fixed time signals. What is it here, Gene?
Yeah, you could have walk intervals up to 30 seconds because they want to get the pedestrians through. And so the pedestrian clearance intervals are set more or closer to the minimum, but walk intervals are very long.
So, but that's still the appetizer. Even though it's long, it's the appetizer. Once it starts going into flashing, don't walk, okay? You're in the main course, all right? And you have, from the time it begins flashing, don't walk, if you were to just start on the first flash, don't walk, you're going to have enough time at 3.5 feet per second to get across the street. If you leave during the walk interval, okay, which is, might be the rapid tick indication from an ADS, then you will certainly have enough time to cross the street unless you are extremely slow. If you are a pedestrian with additional disabilities, then you're going to be, you might need additional time and you might need to request that. But for the most part, if you start during the walk interval, you're in the appetizer, you're in great shape. The walking hand or the rapid tick, you're doing acoustically. The main course starts with the flashing don't walk. Dessert is you if you're still on the road when the red hand goes to solid. Okay. So it's three pieces. Anytime during the walk interval is fine to start. The main course is calculated based upon the width of the street. So it's going to be, it will vary depending if you're crossing the street or an avenue, for example. Okay. Does that make sense to everybody? Yeah? Okay.
My question is this. In New York, this is not quite a problem yet, but I anticipate someday it will be. There are places where light cycles, the times of light cycles vary depending on the automobile traffic on both streets of the intersection. So that one light cycle, the walk time might be 30 seconds. Another light cycle, the walk time might be 18 seconds if there's more traffic, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think they're going to be able to pull that off in New York City, thank God. But is there any plans? Because traffic engineers are not looking for pedestrians. There are no way to sense pedestrians. There's only way to sense automobiles. So these locator buttons and these buttons to activate the traffic signals could be used to indicate to the traffic control system that actually you do have pedestrians crossing here now, just in case you were wondering. Is there any plans for something like that?
Actually, you put your finger on exactly how they do work. That type of variable timing, which is called actuation by traffic engineers, means that to cross a major roadway that intersects a minor roadway, they're going to interrupt the flow on the major roadway for as short as time possible as to get as many cars up and down that road as they possibly can. So if there's one car on the minor roadway, it will only change the light for, 7 to 10 seconds, but if there's 8 or 10 cars, but they'll change the light for, as you said, 20 or 30. Does that make sense to everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if you're a pedestrian waiting to cross that major roadway, there is a pedestrian push button there. And that's what that's for, is it lets the intersection know that you're a pedestrian, and it overlays a pedestrian timing on that crossing. However, if you don't push that button, the intersection does not know you're there. In fact, traffic engineers sometimes call pedestrian push buttons pedestrian detectors. So if you don't push that button, you won't get that timing. Furthermore, if you're blind or visually impaired, you may not know the button is there. And beyond that, if there's no cars there, you don't know when the signal changes. So there's lots of, and that's really was one of the underlying reasons for both Janet and I to get involved in advocating for accessible pedestrian signals, because that type of timing plan is inaccessible and dangerous to people.
And it's quite common when you move out of the downtown area of many cities. I wanted to address one other part of that question, I think, which was want. If you push the button, there is a way for traffic engineers to look and know how often pedestrians have used that push button or how often there is a pedestrian call at an intersection. They aren't always set to record that, but my understanding is the newer type of traffic controllers can say, oh, we had 180 pedestrians here today, so that they can record that button press. The other thing is there has been some movement in what's called pedestrian detection, so that there's video cameras, they can record pedestrians, other kinds of information that may work over time to actually provide the pedestrian information, you know, pedestrian detection in different ways than pressing a button. But at this moment, the most common is pedestrian push buttons and needing to press a button to get that call into the traffic signal controller. But there are some things going on with that, too, that may develop over time.
I wonder where the NSA is on this. They should be.
Okay, it looks as though there are not any more questions that anybody's willing to admit to. So I hope this has been helpful, yes?
Yes.
Before I say a couple things about PASS, I neglected to thank somebody who is a person who has been so helpful and has put in so many hours for PASS. Why am I doing this? Anyway, and who actually hatched this idea and just works too many hours a day on PASS stuff in addition to the other things she has to do. Please give a huge hand to Annalyn Portman. Okay, so we need to make sure that everybody knows how to request an APS, right? Okay, so one way for at least a little while is to request them through Matt Cuvogel, through the NOPD, Mayor's Office of People with Disabilities. What we're going to do at PASS is that we're going to take the same email address that we used, that it won't say Town Hall anymore, at PASSCoalition.org. It's going to say appsrequest@PASSCoalition.org. If you wish to make a request, give us until Monday. Give us until Monday to make sure that that's up and ready. And then if you wish to request as an individual, not for somebody else, but on your own, if you wish to make a request for an APS, you can do it in that way. And you need to make the request. You need to give the location. You need to say why you think it's necessary. And the other thing that PASS has available to us is Jean Borkman, who is here, has very graciously agreed if somebody needs help to figure out the kind of to articulate the reasons why you need an APS or to get some additional help with that, you can request that through PASS. And Jean will contact you, and we can help to make that happen. Is there anything else I need to say about that, Jean?
No.
Okay. So you can use the appsrequest@PASSCoalition.org, and you can give your reasons, and if you think you would like help in making your case, basically, you can indicate that, okay? And we will make every effort to have that happen. We're doing this because, especially, well, first we want to track it better, who's requesting what. We know there are people who want APS and who are not requesting them, or sometimes they request them and they go to 311 and nothing happens, or they go to the DOT website and they get mixed up in a CAPTCHA, and then nothing happens. So we're, at least for the time being, we're going to, PASS is going to take that on to support the mayor's office for people with disabilities, okay? I think, are there any other last questions that you want to ask about PASS or to anybody else who is here this evening? Any last thing anybody wants to say? Okay, it needs to kind of be quick because I think the lighthouse is about to throw us out.
How do APSs and traffic engineers address streets that have turning lanes versus streets that don't? Does that just mean a little longer walk cycle, or what is the philosophy of all of this?
How do traffic engineers address streets that have turning lanes versus ones that don't? Do you mean with like left turn arrows or something of that sort, or just a lot of turning cars?
Yes, left turn arrows or a lot of cars that can turn either way.
Okay. When they have a left turn arrow, usually the pedestrians are held until that arrow is over with, and then the pedestrian gets their time. And that's why sometimes, and that's where I probably got first into needing acceptable pedestrian signals, because otherwise it's hard to tell when that time came in a very complex intersection. The second thing would be, if there's lots of right-turning cars or turning cars, that usually doesn't necessarily make a difference in the pedestrian timing, because the assumption, not always true, is that cars are supposed to yield to pedestrians. But it doesn't always happen. Well, we know that. I don't say that, but I don't think it's... sometimes it's figured into the timing in terms of getting the traffic clear after those pedestrians have been blocking it up, but I don't think that necessarily works for into the figuring for most traffic engineers.
We'll be having another workshop on driving yield.
She just said, we'll be having another workshop on getting drivers to yield later. All right, Karen.
I think that's it. If nobody has anything else, thank you everybody so much, and let's give our presenters a round of applause.
Thank you.
How's your girl doing?
Is there anybody available to help with the sign out?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's a little far. Excellent. Off the step. But it's nothing like Olive did.
She
does more than I'd like, but I told her to stop and then she stopped. So
it's a wonderful girl.
I believe that this girl. Yeah, I'm glad.
I'm glad you had a part of it.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Good. It's great to see you today. Thank you.
Hey, lock on.